administration. Good morning, Governor Ventura.
Hi, Catherine. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, no problem. I love talking to you. You know that.
Now, listen, this is your first big whack at a gigantic policy job. Are you pretty pleased with yourself?
I'm very happy. You know, considering the time frame you're put under, Catherine, I mean, you win an election and you have to have a budget out to the full legislature by no later than February 16th. I thought the people, my finance and revenue people did a remarkable job in being able to get this budget to the legislature before February 1st. But it's you're put under those time constraints the way the system works that you can't really get in and do the tinkering you'd like to do with it, which is what I will do between this budget and the next one, because now I'll have a 2-year period in which to be, you know, more knowledgeable on what, say, what changes or reforms or what things we'd like to do in the next budget.
So this is the first nudge, and we should look forward, at least at this point, to some bigger changes in 2 years.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if changes are needed, you don't change for the sake of change either. Not always. So I think you just, it gives you a chance, though, to look and do a little more studying on what you want to do. And I think the uniqueness about we are making major change here. This is a centrist budget. It's something that has not been practice throughout the United States very much. Minnesota's leading the way on it. You know, usually we get the extreme left, the extreme right, and then they fight, and that's what we're left with. What we came forward with on this, we didn't even think about the left or the right. We came forward with what we thought middle-class Minnesotans would appreciate the most, and that's where we came on this budget, and Democrats or Republicans didn't even enter into the budget. And the other nice thing was I was afforded a position of not having to talk to one lobbyist or one special interest group. They did not enter into the equation, and that's where we move forward.
Well, you know, obviously, your income tax cut helps the middle income the most, and, you know, it's great if you didn't get to have to talk to a lobbyist. But what my question is, would Jesse himself be the special interest person who had the most impact on this budget? There seems to be a sort of personal touch here. I mean, we certainly know from, your talk radio days and elsewhere, there were things you don't like, and poof, they're gone.
Not that many. Certainly your own interest comes in. And if you look at my life, I come from middle class Minnesota. I grew up in South Minneapolis. I have friends today who are still my closest friends who are middle class blue-collar Minnesotans, and so those are the people that I'm in touch with, and they're the people that I deal with on a personal basis. And you always hear the stories about, well, the rich prosper and the very poor prosper and the middle class is left holding the bag, and I think in a lot of ways that's true. And I think that's what we went out to address in this budget, was to make it as fair percentage wise everyone profits in this budget from a tax cut, because we expanded the lower level of where everyone pays their first so many dollars at a certain level, regardless if you make $20,000 a year or if you make $1 million a year. Your first level of income tax is always in that first rate, and we've expanded that to include more Minnesotans, as well as we've lowered that tax rate. So this budget has hit everybody.
I'm curious, when you mentioned that, you mentioned your middle-class friends, the ones you've had for a long time.
Uh-huh.
Does that mean you have a sort of unofficial kitchen cabinet and you run ideas past them, like even ideas for this budget?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not a bit. This is just living life and knowing what goes on out there. Not at all. I mean, the people that I worked with, Fitz was there and Pam Wheelock, as well as Matt Smith, Wayne Simino. I mean, some very, very qualified people throughout the finance and revenue departments. We all worked together from within a week of my taking office all the way up until yesterday. I mean, we were probably getting tired of seeing each other, because we were seeing each other pretty much on a daily basis for a couple hours every day.
Now, there were people who voted for you who truly believed in Retaliate and 98, and their version of that was to see a huge change in government spending. And so from that vantage point, you could see this budget as a bit of a disappointment. How do you answer those people?
Oh, I don't see it as a disappointment at all. Retaliate in 98 simply meant listen to the people. And I think I have. I think that I've come forward. Minnesotans feel very strong about their educational system. They feel very strong that educating our young people is extremely important, both in higher and lower ed. And look at all the grief I took, Catherine, from higher ed when I hadn't even did anything. I mean, every editorial board, every newspaper, talk radio was raking me over the coals saying Jesse doesn't support higher education, and lo and behold, he does, doesn't he?
Your budget doesn't give all the surplus money back, and there are people who are going to be counting those pennies and wondering, you know, what happened to the pledge of 100% of the last surplus.
What surplus isn't being given back?
Well, I'm asking you.
Tell me, what surplus isn't being given back? In fact, I'm trying to give back last year's surplus that they took and bonded. And one must remember, the tobacco settlement is not a surplus. That's the result of a court case. You have to distinguish between what is a surplus and what is the results of a court case.
Well, I guess when the figuring that what we've done over here, it looks like more a little more than 50% when you add up the rebate in the income tax cuts.
A little bit more than 50% what? Is being given back?
Yes.
Well, what surplus is not being given back? I'll repeat the question.
Okay. I see the confusion here. We're including the tobacco money.
Exactly. Exactly. And the tobacco company is not a surplus. That is the result of a settlement with tobacco where we were the plaintiffs. And if we, you know, it's still open to be given back. I mean, if the legislature doesn't like my ideas, they can give the one-time money back. But I just think that it would be far better spent the way that I have it. And I'm not spending it. The principle of that tobacco money will always be intact. It will always be there. So at any time, it could be given back. We just feel that we want to invest that money and use the interest from that money in four different manners that we think both health-wise and people-wise in Minnesota we could profit to make people on the people-wise more self-sufficient down the road so that they're not dependent upon government. We're in league with Michael O'Keefe on that, and he's a brilliant man with some great ideas of public-private partnership to make people more self-reliant.
What do you think is going to happen when your budget goes into the House, where the House Republicans were expecting deeper tax cuts? I'm thinking of Tim Pawlenty, who said yesterday that with regard to the tax cut, your budget may not be dead on arrival, but it's on life support.
Well, that's up to them. I mean, they're the ones that deal with lobbyists and special interest. And if they can get more cuts in there and they want to cut even more and they feel that's what Minnesotans want, they're certainly entitled to do that. But then they have to answer to their special interest groups and their lobbyists, which I don't have to answer to. The other thing, too, is not falling into a trap, Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
If they make these huge knee-jerk cuts, what happens if the economy doesn't prosper like it has in 8 years? I've had meetings with top economists who generally we go on a 4-year cycle of prosperity. We're right now on the end of an 8-year cycle. And they all warned me to be prudent and cautious. They said because the economy we could see a recession over the next 4 years. And if they throw in all these major cuts, then we could be looking at the next budget with a deficit. And who's going to answer for that? Are they going to stand up and say, well, yep, we overcut everything and now we have a deficit, so now we have to raise taxes? Is Tim going to do that? Or is Tim going to try to shift the blame to me?
I was really struck by what an impression those economists made when they talked to you, because it almost seemed that there had been a sort of change in the tenor of how you thought about giving the money back, that, you know, you did become much more prudent. And so my question is, you also at one point said that you didn't want the state budget to increase by one dime. You wanted people to manage within the money they already had. And yet this budget does increase.
It has to. 80% of your budgets go for salaries, Catherine. and you have collective bargaining agreements out there that have to be adhered to. Everybody gets raises. Let's take a look at my budget and compare it to the last 8 years. My budget is growing at around 2.9%, which is well under the forecasted personal family income growth. We are underneath the growth of personal family income. In the last 8 years, the budget has been almost twice of what personal family income growth has been.
But it is, so, of course,
wait,
over the rate
was,
of...
Wait, and this was under a Republican governor who the Republicans are now criticizing me. Well, put their money where their mouth was. Where were they over the last 8 years of decreasing that budget?
Well, of course, it is over the rate of inflation, not, I mean, by 0.4%. I guess that's why I'm, what I'm trying to get at here is...
Well, that 0.4% is going to education, Catherine. 70% of all my new spending goes for education, and that seems to be what Minnesotans want to do with it. Now, you can beg to differ with me. Tell me, do you think it's bad spending?
I'm just trying to get you to, you know, explain it more. That's all.
I am explaining it.
And
I'm explaining
calm down.
Quite clearly.
I'm not attacking you, Jesse. I'm just saying that it strikes me that last fall, there's been a sea change in you've become a governor, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And what you said as a campaigner and what you're doing as a governor, I'm seeing, I think, the education of Jesse Ventura, and that's what I'm trying to get you to address.
Well, and maybe that's so a little bit. Like I said, you know, in speaking with economists, they told me to be cautious.
Uh-huh.
They, and these are top guys in the field, and they certainly know more than I do. And I'm not afraid to admit that. That's why you surround yourself with people who are more qualified in the fields that they deal in than what you can be. I mean, who could be qualified in 24 different departments, which is what it's required over here as governor? So you put people in place like Christine Jacks in charge of education. You put people in place that have expertise in those fields, and then you go out and they advise you, and you take their, you know, you take what they tell you on, under, what you do.
Now, I'm curious. The House Republicans wanted $80 million for property tax relief for farmers, and your budget called for $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
Do you consider farmers special interests?
No, I don't. I consider what we need to do, and my attitude is far more Republican than theirs is. They're going to do an $80 million across the board, Catherine. Guess who would get relief from that? I would.
How so?
Because I'm a farmer. I have a farm, and I have a crop product, and under there, it'll be an across-the-board blanket relief for all farmers, so therefore I would get property tax relief on my farm. What we have done is we've targeted very Republican. We've gone out, and we're going to put the money in the hands of the counties and allow each farmer to come forward and show their need, and that way the locals would have the ability to determine what is need and what is not need.
Now let's talk for a minute about you know, the bulk of your budget is K through 12 education. Tell me how this money is going to reflect your priorities for education.
Well, my priorities are simple. I'm a product of public education. I believe that at one time in our state we had the finest public education in the country. I believe our public education is still good, but it certainly can be improved. And what we're doing is we're providing the mechanism and the means for the public education system to get back on top again, but we're doing it in a manner that they will have to be responsible, that they will have to show that they're achieving the goals that we're setting out for them. That's higher test scores and better perception of what public education is going to be, so that, you know, I want to see the word voucher disappear. And that can happen by simply making our public schools the best they can possibly be. And then you won't hear people crying out for vouchers and all of this stuff, because people will be satisfied with their public school education. We're also keeping it very focused on local involvement, local decisions, local people deciding what's best for their schools. And then if they don't respond, well, my budgets in the future won't be as good to them.
Now, you're going to increase tourism. It was sort of interesting for me to discover that the tourism budget had been the same for a very long time, and you upped it to $9 million. So my question is, are you really going to be in the commercials for the state?
Oh, I don't know if I will. They haven't asked me, and it's not up to me, but I'll tell you why I did that. all studies and indications show that we're getting $9 of tourism money for every $1 we spend. Now, I come from the private sector, and I learned very clearly out there that you have to spend money to make money. And when you're getting a 9-to-1 return, that is phenomenal. I mean, Jerry Carlson, my Commissioner of Trade and Economic Development, who comes totally from the private sector, he has given this the total go-ahead because he's a private sector person who understands that if you're getting a $9 return on every $1 you spend, that's remarkable, and we need to exploit that more. I thought it was long overdue. And I think in light, Catherine, if I may interject myself a little bit, we are now the number one talked about state in the United States of America. Whenever you go anywhere today, people want to know about Minnesota, and I think it's smart that we capitalize on that. Our state has so much to offer, from the Mall of America to our lakes to our beautiful scenery, our four seasons that we all know and love. That's why we stay here, isn't it? And I think that we can exploit this and make and turn it into huge dollars for the state of Minnesota and the tourist industry.
You know, actually, one of the reasons I stay here is because I regard Minnesota as a cultural capital. So I'm curious, you know, what your outlook is on funding for the arts.
Funding for the arts? I don't know. I don't make art. I buy it, Catherine.
I think you know what I'm talking about.
You know,
don't even try.
Do you know where that came from? I got to tell you. You know where that quote came from? When I did the movie Predator with Joel Silver, he was being questioned one day on the artistic of his films because they're action films, and Joel looked at all the press and says, "I don't make art, I buy it." And I always thought that was pretty good. For the arts, hey, we live in a capitalist society, and you know, I believe very strongly in self-reliance, and we're asking our people to take a stronger position on that in the future. And I think that everything else has to do it too. You know, you can't just subsidize everything, you know. What's one person's cup of tea is not another, and who makes those decisions over, you know, what is art and what isn't art?
Well, I guess I'm thinking of the museums in the state. I'm thinking of community arts programs. I'm thinking of theaters. It seems to me that that's actually, you could make the same argument for some of the state arts funding that you can for tourism and the movie industry.
Well, I don't think so, because are they bringing in a 9-to-1 return?
I don't know if they're bringing in the 9-to-1 return, but I do think that they add a lot in terms of the tourism incentive.
Well, maybe so, and we'll certainly look at that, and certainly maybe if our tourism money comes in strongly, one can lead to the other, can't it?
Well,
if tourism money starts flowing in because of our advertising of our tourism, it's going to give us more money to be able to play with because of all the tax dollars that we'll bring in because of tourism, and then we can reinvest into those cultural things and keep them on the up and up too.
I want to talk to you again, getting back to politics. Are you worried at all that the DFLers seem to be happier with your budget than the Republicans?
No, because we didn't go in thinking DFL or Republican. It never entered into our thoughts on our budget. We sat down, we laid out our principles of what we wanted to accomplish and what we felt a very centrist position was in Minnesota, and that's the unique thing. That's the thing we need to be pounding home, is that we're finally getting a centrist viewpoint over here rather than a radical left and a radical right and then somehow coming to meet in the middle. We're getting a centrist viewpoint from the get-go, which I think was the result of this election, because I provided a centrist viewpoint in the election. I always have. I'm fiscally fairly conservative. I'm socially moderate to liberal, which is what I think most Minnesotans are, and they voted accordingly, and that's what they're getting here. Is they need to look at this is a good, solid centrist attitude on this budget that both caters somewhat to the right and somewhat to the left, but basically stays down the middle of the road.
Now, your centrist vision of Minnesota, does that also embrace diversity? There's going to be a press conference today. Boy, in just about half an hour, black Minnesotans denounced Governor Ventura's failure to appoint blacks to cabinet posts. How do you handle that?
Well, I think I'm colorblind.
You're colorblind,
yeah.
But there's still, you know...
No, I'm colorblind. I mean, I should have never been a Navy SEAL. I had to cheat to get in.
Oh, that's right. I remember.
I'm
you
colorblind.
Are colorblind.
And so I take my colorblindness into what I do. And my point is... in order to become a cabinet member, you have to apply. We don't go out on a search.
Not a single person of color applied to be on your cabinet?
Maybe they may have. I don't know, because we had a screening process that's qualified the most qualified people to come forward. And that I was not part of in the screening process. We had people involved in that with very much expertise in that type of work in the private sector. And that's the process that went through. And then I would get the three or four finalists in it. But color does not enter into it. Neither does gender, and neither does sexual orientation. Those are three criterias that I don't think about when I interview a candidate. I think about who's best qualified to carry out the job that I want to have done. And that's how I've made my selections, and I think this is really much ado about nothing, because I don't work that way. In the military, I served with every person, every race, creed, and color there. I've never, ever been biased in any decisions I've made throughout my life concerning that, and I'm certainly not now, and I can look myself in the mirror and say that.
Now, speaking of biases, let's talk about those cuts for public broadcasting, especially TV and radio. You know, I just get the gig, and you cut the funding. What's going on here?
Well, first of all, I'll ask you, why do you need to be subsidized?
Well, you know, I'm actually not so much worried about my paycheck. I'm worried about those stations out there in the state who aren't part of NPR, who are community-based, who do a lot of great work. And my question to you is, have you really looked at this, or is this just part of, because you and I both know that we have been surrounded by people who have true enmity for public broadcasting?
Well, my view is that, if something is, I don't know, I guess I look at it as, what is the purpose of public subsidy for broadcasting?
I think it's to give people a product that isn't market-driven, but is actually mission-driven.
Okay.
I mean, listen, and you and I both know.
So we're catering to a small minority then.
I don't think you're catering to a small minority. What you're doing is you're putting something out there that isn't driven by the market, and it's available to whoever wants it.
Right.
Right.
Well, then I should take the same attitude then in my dealings with other businesses. Whether they can survive or not shouldn't matter. I guess it should come down to the fact of whether somebody out there would have the opportunity to partake in that business, and then therefore we should subsidize it.
I have a feeling you and I could argue about this for a very long time.
I do too. My other question is, I've worked at radio stations where we have to go out in the competition, and we wire our mics together with wire, we use duct tape and all this stuff, and I've also been to public radio where there's four or five producers on each show.
Ha! First of all, let me just say, I wish there were four or five producers for each show, and I know exactly what radio station you're talking about that uses duct tape. You and I both know. And let me just say this to you. Instead of putting the money in the profit margin, they put it in the product here. And four or five producers for each show. In my dreams. We don't have enough pledge drives to do that. All right, final question,
okay.
Jesse. What's with the concealed weapon? You're the most protected guy in the state. You have armed bodyguards. Are you afraid of somebody?
Am I afraid of someone? Why? Why would I need to be afraid?
Well, I don't know. Why do you have...
Well, Catherine, why do I have bodyguards?
You got me.
Oh, you don't think a public official needs one?
Well,
you don't think that I get daily death threats? You don't believe that? I mean,
the
point is, you're on the outside. You haven't been on the inside. You have no idea that there are sick people in the world.
No, actually,
and if that's the case, why do we have the Secret Service for the president? Why do I have bodyguards? Why do I need all that?
Well, hang on a minute. I understand the need for bodyguards.
You do? Yes, doesn't sound like it.
Well, what I don't understand is why you need the concealed weapon, because it seems to me that when you're
the governor... I don't have a concealed weapon. I simply have a license to have one.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification, but even
I have the license for it. Well, okay, Catherine. What about if I go out on my own? What if my security is not with me at some point in time?
I guess... I can understand why at a public event you'd need an armed bodyguard, but it strikes me that as governor, when you get a permit for a concealed weapon, it's an action that has repercussions far beyond just, you know,
and how, and what are those
citizens.
Repercussions?
What you're saying is this is a good, okay thing to do.
No, I'm a good, okay thing to do. Catherine, I was over here at the Capitol and hadn't even been here 3 days when someone planted a bomb over here. And I had to be evacuated from the building. You seem to have a very naive attitude that you think that people in my position are not under some sort of danger at 24 hours a day. What do you think these people, when someone goes out and shoots a John Lennon, why do they do it? They do it because they're looking for a high-profile person so that they can get plenty of media attention when they make the attempt. I think you better pick up a few books and read about it.
Well, I'll take your scholarly advice to heart.
Well, you're laughing it off.
No.
Excuse me, wasn't John Kennedy assassinated?
Yes, Jesse.
Yes, he was. And don't you think that no danger comes with the position of being a governor? You think that everyone out there is patting me on the back and pleased with me?
I think that with public life comes public threats, and I understand that.
And I shouldn't take those serious.
No, what I'm asking you is, with armed bodyguards, why there's a need for a concealed weapon permit, and if there was some larger message behind that.
There's no larger message behind it, and let me give you an example. When I was mayor of Brooklyn Park, I went up to Camp Ripley with about six different police agencies, and that particular day was sniper shooting. And guess what? I tied the top sniper that was up there shooting. I'm very qualified.
Well, I have a feeling that you've shot well with your budget as well.
Well, you know, I'm just disturbed over you somehow think there's some bad message because I have a license to carry concealed and protect myself. What's the bad message?
I think that there are people out there who probably don't need to be carrying guns, who don't need to be carrying concealed weapons, and they see you doing it, and they think, hey, this is okay.
Do they say that about a police officer?
Well, but you're not a police
officer. Yes, I am. I'm the head of all of them. I am the head of the State Patrol. I am the head of the National Guard. I am the Commander-in-Chief of the National Guard. I see nothing at all from where you're coming from.
Jesse, I have to let you go.
Okay.
Only because I know that they only allotted you half an hour. I want to thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Catherine.
I hope you come back on so we can wrangle some more.
I sure will.
All right.
Very
you take
good.
Care.
Bye-bye.
All right. This is Catherine Lanfrey.